Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ruth Morgan, a historian at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. Today, we're talking to Greg Mittman, the Vilest Research and William Coleman Professor of History, Medical History, and Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Greg has written widely in environmental history, including Documenting the World, Film, Photography, and the Scientific Record, Breathing Space, How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Landscape, as well as Real Nature, America's Romance with Wildlife on Film. And when he's not writing books, he's working on films, having recently co-produced and co-directed two award-winning films about Liberia with Sarita Sigal, In the Shadow of Ebola and The Land Beneath Our Feet. Today, though, we'll be talking to Greg about his latest book, Future Remains, A Cabinet of Curiosities for the Anthropocene, which he has co-edited with Marco Amiro and Rob Emmett. Welcome, Greg. Thanks for coming on board.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Greg, can you tell us a little bit about your collaboration with Marco and Rob?
Yeah, well, it started in the fall of 2014, where we had this idea for an Anthropocene Slam, which was sponsored by the Center for Cultural History and Environment at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Rachel Carson Center for Environment and Society in Munich, and the Environmental Humanities Lab in Stockholm. And we issued an international call to artists, anthropologists, sociologists, a wide range of scholars, scientists, natural scientists, humanists, artists, writers, to pitch an object that they thought characterized our relationship to the Anthropocene, this new age of humans, as it's called, in some unique way. And we were deluged with submissions. We got over 72 objects. And out of that, we chose 25, where people then came to Madison and pitched these objects in a very performative, playful space. They had 10 minutes to pitch these objects amidst a crowd. And it was just a really creative atmosphere. In fact, so creative that one person who came with one object was so inspired by what he saw happening that that night tossed away his idea for an object, wrote a play, and the play was performed the next day in front of an audience. So that generated the idea of this. And from that, a number of objects, 15 of those objects, then became part of a Cabinet of Curiosities display within the Deutsches Museum's exhibit, Welcome to the Anthropocene, which is, as my understanding, the first major international museum exhibit on the Anthropocene. And then out of that, we brought together the people that had pitched these objects and that had been selected for this Cabinet of Curiosities to write a group of essays around each of the objects. We were fortunate to get a very acclaimed commercial photographer, Tim Flash from London, to come and shoot images of the objects. And then we commissioned other environmental humanities scholars to engage with this wider collection to write more reflective essays that are also a part of the book.
It's an incredible collection, Greg, and it's so international. Can you give us a little bit of a background to the idea of a Cabinet of Curiosities?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think, you know, working in this really interdisciplinary space in the environmental humanities, where people are coming with very different sets of languages, very different disciplinary approaches, was, where does one find common ground? And in my experience, that it's much easier to engage in an interdisciplinary conversation around a landscape or an object where people can come together and talk about it from, you know, their different theoretical frameworks, from their different disciplinary apparatuses. But it's very grounded, right, in the materiality of this specific thing or this specific place. And it really fosters that kind of interdisciplinary collaboration. At the same time, it's a gesture back really to the, you know, the Wunderkammern of the 16th and 17th century, where we had this really hybrid collection of nature and human artifacts produced together and you know, and mixed together in this kind of cornucopia, if you will, of, you know, within a cabinet. And so it was this, it was also speaking to that kind of creative artistic dimension and this hybrid of both nature and artifice, which to us really also spoke of the Anthropocene and the kinds of interdisciplinary conversations that it has been generating across the arts, humanities, and natural sciences and social sciences.
I'll pick you up on a couple of things there. And one thing that jumped out to me in the book, and also just in your talking about it, is the relationship between environmental humanities, environmental history, with public history and museums. I'm wondering, why is that proving to be such a productive relationship?
You know, I think there is such a craving now, you know, within the academy and within the humanities as well, and really engaging with the public, and particularly in these, you know, critical issues of our time, such as climate change, ocean acidification, you know, extinction, that are, you know, impacting everyone on the planet in differential ways. That to really engage with the public is really, really important. And one of the things that we really challenged the contributors to this volume was to really try and write in a way that was more of a creative nonfiction style. So these are very short essays, 3,000 words or so, meant to be short, meant to be engaging, and so that anybody can dip in to this volume is our hope, and particularly you know, undergraduates. I mean, we see this as a real teaching tool, and so it's really within that frame, I think, that you know, there was a real interest really from the start of this project to engage in different formats. So, you know, we started with this slam, this very performative space where, you know, we had an audience of 100 people. Elizabeth Colbert came and gave the opening keynote. We had over 600 people in the audience for that. So it really brought in members of the community. It then became part of this really very popular exhibition at the Deutsches Museum in the Welcome to the Anthropocene exhibit, you know, and now it's taken this book form. And I think also working across these different media formats has been also really important and critical to what it means to produce humanities scholarship now.
So, Greg, what are some of the objects that appear in this book? There's such an amazing photography section in there. What were you looking at?
So there's a whole range of objects, you know, starting with, in terms of the gallery images, a manual pesticide spray prompt from the 1950s, a jar of sand in a kimchi jar, concrete as it was just poured and mixed. A object which we, as the author calls Hoya Echoes, that Tim Flash put together in photographing this extinct bird, the Hoya, with a transcription of the song that it makes. And it's based on, it's a rather amazing object in that the only actual material trace in some ways that we have of this extinct bird is through taxidermy specimens, and also the recording of a Maori man who is imitating the sound of the Hoya that is now had been recorded after the Hoya bird had gone extinct. So that's just a sampling of some. There's a monkey wrench, a cryogenic freezer box, a mirror, marine satellite tags, a special object known as snarge, which is a technical term for animal matter that has been left from a human collision with a wildlife. And there's a number of others as well.
So somehow your contributors have managed to represent both human and more than human or non-human representations. How important was that to the project?
That was absolutely critical to the project and really to try and capture the kind of multivalence and kind of multi-species nature of the way in which, you know, the Anthropocene as this new era is really impacting all forms of life across the planet, and really to think more broadly and critically about those differential impacts, not only, you know, among humans, but among different species throughout the world.
And with your description of the extinct bird and the song or the impersonation of its call by a past man, how do emotions work in this setting? It's such a provocative set of objects.
Yeah, and one of the things that we were really trying to do too in this project is to capture those really different range of emotions, those different emotional registers and valences that are really embodied in this moment that we're living in and you know, perhaps epic that we're living in. You know, from kind of emotional responses of hubris and of a kind of, you know, reflective in grand geoengineering projects that are, you know, think that we're going to be able to engineer our ways, engineer ourselves out of this warming planet. And that is, I think, reflected in one of the essays, for example, by Joe Masco on the Plowshare film, which is reflective of an effort during the Cold War by the Atomic Energy Commission and Edward Teller, a nuclear physicist, that thought that we could conduct these large-scale nuclear engineering projects by, you know, blowing off atomic bombs that were going to build, you know, canals and so forth. So there's that kind of, you know, one emotional response is this kind of, you know, ultimate hubris to much more elegiac responses, to ones of loss and despair. But also one of the common, I think, things that runs throughout it is a deep curiosity, right? And interest of paying attention, of noticing these small objects and how they can reveal or open up big questions about scales of time, about our interrelationships among each other and among living things as well.
Scale was something that really jumped out at me with this book, and it often does in any conversation about the Anthropocene. But I'm really interested in the local, if you like, of the object, but how it can embody the planetary. Is that something that these objects are doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, is really one of the virtues, if you will, of having this more object-centered historical approach. And the ways in which it does able one through a very concrete, you know, specific thing, allow one to weave in these much larger stories across time and across space. So I think, for example, of, you know, Bethany Wiggins' object, the calico quilt, which is it's a piece of fabric of a quilt made by a Quaker that's a print of William Penn and the treaty that was negotiated with the settlement in Pennsylvania with the Lenape Indians, and it shows this, it reveals this really ambivalence and, you know, irony of this Quaker abolitionist at the same time that she was quilting out of this cotton fabric that was very much implicated and imbricated in the slave trade, you know, the very materiality of it. And so it, you know, ties in, it's a very intimate story, but connects us to these really much larger scale political, economic, you know, and forces and very much tied to colonialism and conquest and slavery. An object like a jar of sand, which by Thomas Matza and Nicole Heller, who are on this beach in North Carolina with their children, and one of their children's asked this, you know, question of why is the sand striated? And it takes them into this journey about geological forces and tidal forces, and then takes them into this whole process of beach nourishment beach property and you know, property ownership and the changing property ownership in that area, and what needs to be done to keep this a valuable property by re-nourishing the beaches as erosion is taking the sand away. And so again, it, you know, it's this very small object that raises really, really big questions.
Yeah, big questions like capitalism and colonialism, which make me think of whose Anthropocene or whose objects are these representing, and these questions of inequality and contribution, if you like, or responsibility. I was wondering how you've grappled with, I suppose, representation and these sorts of issues in the collection.
Yeah, you know, and that's one of the things we are, you know, we're quite explicit about in the book, is that this is very much a you know, a collection and a perspective largely from the global north. And, you know, one of the thoughts that we had early on in this project was that this cabinet really needs to circulate and grow, and that different places need to would it be great if it traveled and different places added their own objects, right, that were more reflective of their own positionalities and of those places and of the histories in those particular places. So, you know, what would such a cabinet look like, right, if it was being put together by people in different parts of the world, you know, say in a place like Liberia where I work, you know, that the that would look quite different, right, than the Western European objects that are mostly reflected in this cabinet. Oh, no, not all. There's a painting by Tricia Carroll and Mandy Martin that uses Wiradjuri art and X-ray painting of, you know, based on this Aboriginal tradition of art in Australia, and to really weave together dream time and contemporary time, and in thinking about the current landscape in this place around Davies Creek, where both Trish and Mandy live.
So I was really struck by the way that the collection tries to evoke an ecological view of the world in contrast to the Anthropocene's emphasis on geological time and geological strata. And I think that's a really interesting tension, if you like, in the debates that continue to go on about naming the Anthropocene. How are you seeing this play out?
You know, as someone who has worked, you know, most of their career in thinking about ecology and the history of ecology as a science and so forth, one of the striking things to me really about the last couple decades is the way in which the earth sciences have in some ways taken over the meaning of and notion of what constitutes the environment. In a way that, you know, if we were in the 1950s and 60s, it would be the biologists that were and ecologists that were really front and center of that conversation. And now it's not as much the case. Obviously, in certain areas, it is, particularly, you know, for example, when we're talking about questions of extinction. But in terms of, you know, climate change, this is you know, really a conversation that is in which atmospheric chemists, geoscientists are very much, you know, in the climate modelers are very much in the fore of that. And so if you look, I mean, even in terms of the history of the concept of the Anthropocene, right, the coin was the term was coined jointly by Eugene Stormer, who was a paleoecologist, and Paul Crutzen, an atmospheric chemist. And it's interesting to me, even really over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years or so, the way in which Stormer's name has even dropped out of, you know, the conversation. And in some ways, it's symbolic to me of the way in which ecology and life has in some ways dropped out of the conversation when we're thinking about the kind of genealogies of the Anthropocene.
When we think about the Anthropocene, it's a very future oriented concept, and I wondered how you have thought about the future in terms of these objects providing like an archive or fossils of a present. And I thought that was a really interesting play with temporality. Could you reflect a bit more on the future side of this project?
Yeah, you know, I think that probably one of the objects I think that really speaks to that quite tellingly is a fossil blackberry made by Jared Farmer. So it's a technofossil, right? There's this whole genre of art known as technofossils that is, you know, this extinct human device, right? The blackberry or virtually extinct. And the way in which it, you know, the kind of fossilization of that, if you will, the remains of that, that might, you know, would possibly survive into the future, reflects a particular historical moment, in humanity's time on Earth. So that, in many ways, these, we talk about this, you know, these remains, these objects are in some ways more symbolic of that, of, you know, of a, the tarot cards of a fortune teller kind of looking into the future than they are of a geologist looking into the past. I mean, I think Liz Hennessy's object, the cryogenic freezer box, is again a kind of projection into the future. You know, one of these boxes that are used in these de-extinction experiments where you're freezing life in with the hopes that someday in the future the technology will be there to bring these species that have gone extinct back to life, you know, very much in a kind of Jurassic Park framework. So it's very much, you know, taking these objects in the here and now, but thinking about them in the context of a future, which we don't know what the world will be like yet.
So what is the next step for the Cabinet of Curiosities? Where does it go from here?
Well, I mean, I think the book itself is the final product, if you will. You know, we started with the SLAM. That SLAM has been duplicated in other parts of the world. I know that they've had one in Switzerland. They've had one in Australia. The notion of the cabinet, I think, is, you know, that I think they're even in the museum spaces. And Libby Robin writes about this in her essay in the volume. There's a kind of revival, if you will, of a kind of cabinet of curiosities among artists in museum spaces. And so, you know, I think we're seeing more and more of that kind of exhibition work that's happening. And then, you know, with the book in hand now, it's our kind of end stage of the project, but we hope that the idea is taken up by others and circulated throughout the world.
It's a fantastic model, and I hope it does continue to contribute to a conversation around the environmental humanities and museums and about the Anthropocene, of course. Now, Greg, I know you've been working a lot in film lately. What's next for you as we come to the end of our conversation?
So I am currently at work on a book on the impact and legacy of Firestone Plantations Company in Liberia, which founded a rubber plantation in Liberia in 1926 that would become the world's largest rubber plantation, and looking at its economic, environmental, and social impacts up to the present day. And that's actually led us into another scene project, if you will, and that's taking up seriously the notion of the plantationocene, which, you know, was a term that was introduced by Donna Haraway and Anant Singh, I think, in somewhat in response to the, definitely in response to the Anthropocene, much like we're getting all these other scenes, Capitalocene, right, Chthulocene, but we're taking on a project at Madison to really interrogate the notion of the plantationocene and really looking at 400 years of plantations, both in the past and present, in terms of their widespread global impacts, both economics, environmental, and social.
It makes me wonder, Greg, what's in a name when it comes to plantationocene, Anthropocene? Is that something that has been an issue putting such a collection together and in the work that you're doing as you go on?
I think, you know, each of these terms, you know, whether we're talking about the Capitalocene or the plantationocene or the Anthropocene, captures, you know, a particular aspects of of kind of periodization of history, if you will, that, and none of them are complete, right? None of them quite capture the global forces and processes at play, right? So one of the critiques, and when we started the Anthropocene Slam, we meant that literally in the sense that it was both in the spirit of a kind of poetry slam, but it was also meant in terms of slamming the Anthropocene. That is, that we both wanted to think with and against the Anthropocene. And so many of the essays in the volume, and particular Laura Pulido's essay on racism in the Anthropocene, really think critically about, you know, the we, as, because one of the things that happens in the Anthropocene is as we scale up to humans at the species level, the differential impacts and the differential ways in which people are contributing, for example, to global climate change gets lost, and the issues around environmental justice get lost in that scaling up. And so, as you were asked earlier, like, who's the we in this, right? And I think one of the virtues of something like the Plantationocene is that it really gets deeply at these issues of colonialism and racial capitalism that are deeply embedded in the kinds of environmental crises and issues that we're facing today, and that we can't ignore them, though, you know, that longer history. And so I think we need these different scenes together to think collectively about the widespread kind of global change that we're seeing in the context of not just global climate change, but a whole set of forces and tied to, for example, capitalism and extraction, and huge wealth inequalities that are really reconstituting the planet and living creatures within it, including us as humans.
Well, Greg, I've taken up a lot of your time already, but this is a fantastic collection and a very provocative one that I think is just going to keep building and making us reflect on how we think about the Anthropocene and the objects we live with that are quite ordinary. I think that's just something that's a really fascinating exercise. So thank you for joining me today, and thank you for listening to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.